If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
On this episode of History Worth Saving, we're talking to a good friend of mine, a guy who was reared down in Enterprise, Alabama, went off to pharmacy school, became one of the largest drug dealers on the East Coast, the legal way, and has spent his life telling the story of our airmen from the World War II generation. The men who kept saying, in his words, "Put me in, coach." They knew that these missions that they were flying were missions that had less than the chance of winning a coin toss for survivability. These were dangerous, but they were necessary. And Larry Kelly has spent his life reminding us of these stories. In fact, in just a few more days, for the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, Larry Kelly will be flying his own B-25 Mitchell, a World War II bomber, in part of a huge flyover called the Arsenal of Democracy, right up and over downtown Washington, D.C., to help commemorate that. But when I met Larry, it was in the airplane that he loves, Panchito, the B-25, to help tell one of these stories back in my days in television. By the way, if you have not already subscribed to the History Worth Saving newsletter, please do so right there at historyworthsaving.com. Larry Kelly, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Matt. Thank you for having me on.
Did I get that right? Largest drug dealer on the East Coast. I love the ring of that. But
yeah, well, that sort of caught my attention, too. Well, our specialty was... And still is, because I still work for Remedy Senior Care, which is one of the largest in the country right now. But our specialty was pharmacy services provided to long-term care, meaning assisted living facilities, nursing facilities, and other types of institutional settings where an in-house pharmacy was not available. So we provided the same type of services as an in-house pharmacy does, like in a hospital. But we provide it from a centralized location in industrial parks.
Now, how does a guy from Enterprise, Alabama, grow up to become a pharmacist in Metro DC? Because there's a huge gap there.
Well, some people may laugh at it, but, growing up down south, I was the first ever in my family going back to the Revolutionary War to ever go to college. So I didn't have a whole lot of experience in the family, even though my parents were very hardworking, good, honest Christian folks. But they didn't know anything about how to advise me about going to college. But also, they instilled upon me that going to college was not an option. It was mandatory. Like many people of that generation, wanted their kids to have something better than they did. But, I'm sitting down, I first enrolled in a community college and I thought accounting would be my forte. I'd be an accountant, right? Well, after a couple of semesters of bookkeeping courses and stuff, I decided I was not that kind of with a bunch of books and do numbers kind of a person. So I literally got a paperback book about careers and I started thumbing through this little paperback, and I still have that paperback. And I was reading in there about all different kind of careers and different kind of professions and what they are and what they do. And I came across pharmacist, and my mind immediately went to old Doc Mitchell there in Enterprise. So when we kids get sick, we didn't go to the hospital. We didn't go to the emergency room. We went to the druggist. And the druggist would come in on a Sunday, and he would see us, and he would give us medicines. And I just always remember what an important part of our community old Doc Mitchell was, and how everybody respected him. I said, I want to be like Doc Mitchell. So I did. I changed my major to pharmacy, and I was scared to death. Here I am, a simple country farm boy, and I'm in college, and I was scared to death. How in the world am I going to survive this with all of these smart people? So my first semester, I had a 4.0 grade point average, and I looked around the room. I said, well, I guess I'm just about as dumb as the rest of them, or they're as dumb as I am, one of the others. Maybe I will survive this. And so I did 2 years community college, and then went off to Auburn University, did my 3 years of professional school, because it's a 5-year curriculum. You know, at the time, the hard thing was I was having to work full time, had a little small restaurant enterprise while I was going to school at Auburn, which is 100 miles away.
Now we have to stop right there, because this is an important part of the story that a lot of people, unless they're really nosy friends like I am, are going to know about you. You actually started this, well, you worked at this pizza joint, and then you bought it while you were in school, General Jackson's Pizza.
Yeah, General Jackson's Pizza. A colonel can fry good chicken, but it takes a general to make a delicious pizza.
There you go.
We had that on the wall, and we believed it. We did we put everything we could put into that, and we treated people right, and it became very, very successful. And after I graduated college and my parents continued to run the business, it became my younger brother was involved by then, and my parents wound up making my father, who was a carpenter, and my mother was a housekeeper, wound up making a comfortable living for themselves and their, up till their retirement, as they continued to run the business. My dad built a new building, expanded it, did very well. But, working full time and going to college full time, 100 miles apart, was quite a challenge. And I only wrecked 2 cars during those 3 years, falling asleep, driving back and forth. But at least I survived both of the accidents. But after college, I went to work as a pharmacist down in Mobile Infirmary. And like many people right out of college, I had this great zeal for, research and, making a change in the world. So I did some original research, published an article in Alabama Journal of Pharmacy, and the director of pharmacy where I was working in Mobile Infirmary wanted to take a look at it before I sent it in, since it was going to be my first published article. So I gave it to him to review. He wound up reviewing it, sending it on in for me, and then wound up adding his name to it when he did nothing more than just simply review it. So I decided I can't work for this man. So I called some friends who had already gone to work up in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins and said, hey, y'all hiring up there? And they put me in touch with John Newcomb, who was the assistant director of pharmacy and in charge of personnel. So I called John, talked to him for a little bit, hung up the phone. I'm thinking, I just wasted his time, my time for a half hour. And then a week later, a airline ticket showed up in the mail. This is back in the days, when they actually had a paper airline ticket. Got an airline ticket and a letter inviting me to come for an interview. I said, what the heck? So I got out a map, figured out where Baltimore was. Got out on an airplane, flew to Baltimore, and did an interview. Took up most of his day and my day, and flew back home and thinking, okay, well, I just wasted his day and my day. And a week later, a job invitation letter showed up in the mail where they offered me a job. And I said, what the heck? So I packed up my car, what little bit of belongings I had, and moved to Baltimore. Went to work at Johns Hopkins, and 3.5 years later, John and I left. Went into business for ourselves, started our own business with the institutional, background that we had, and grew that into one of the largest pharmacies in our type of specialty in our market. And then in 1997, we had some folks come along and made us what we thought was a ridiculous offer. So we sold the business, and then after a little hiatus, I joined up with some friends who had started a new robotic dispensing system, and I said, I want to be part of that. This can be fun without having to worry about payroll, just worry about taking care of customers and taking care of clients and my specialty, which is pain management. Started doing that. But back as a kid, I when I was 9 years old, my uncle, you know, we didn't have a whole lot. You know, we had a 1952 Chevrolet, and this is in the mid 60s. You know, that was our car, our family car. And the house we lived in, my dad and my uncle built. But I had another uncle, Jug Brown, who was an A&P mechanic and an IA and maintained for Beechcraft the Queen Airs out at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And but he had bought a wrecked Taylor craft. Thunderstorm had turned it over and tore it up, and he's going to rebuild it. And like the old Shake and Bake commercial, and I helped. Okay. So, you know, as a nine-year-old, I'm out there helping him, and I was just fascinated with this little airplane. And so it took us about a year and a half to totally rebuild the airplane.
And for those of you who don't know, this thing is made out of metal tubing and wood and fabric. I mean, it's as simple as it gets.
Yeah. It's a very, very simple. Didn't even have an electric starter. Didn't have an electrical system. You started it with hand prop him. He taught me how to hand prop it. And he'd get in the airplane, and we would prime the carburetor and pull a propo through a couple of times, and then the old classic, like in the movies, you know, mags on, mags on. And I'd pull that thing through it, it'd start, and I'd run, jump in the right seat. We'd take off. Enterprise Airport back then was a grass airfield. We'd climb up to 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet. He would reach over, kill the magneto, pull the nose up, kick the rudder hard, kick it into a spin. We'd spin that thing all the way down to just before the ground, and he'd pull it out of the spin and land it and say, yeah, start it again. And I'd get out. We would pull that thing through, start it. Here we go. Go do it again. Or we had fun doing that. I never would forget the fascination I had with that. And a few times we would fly down to Geneva, Alabama, land on a little country road, taxi up to the Dairy Queen, sit in that little Taylor craft and have a burger and a milkshake. And then Uncle Brown, he'd call the sheriff and tell the sheriff. Of course, you had to use pay phones back then. He'd go pay phone and call the sheriff. Sheriff would come out, block the road. We'd take off, fly back to Enterprise. Like, can you imagine doing that today?
Well, but, not legally and not getting away with it.
but, you know, that was aviation in the 50s and right. In you know, South Alabama. You know, airplanes themselves were rarities. You know, especially for privately owned airplanes, there weren't that many. What few private airplanes were around were mostly crop dusters, old Stearmans. And out at Enterprise Airport, I used to go out and I'd wash airplanes and hot rides and Fairchild PT-19s and Ryan PT-22s, Stearmans. You know, most of the airplanes that were available to the public then were, you know, for the public where I lived, was just World War II surplus stuff that, you know, people bought and just kept on flying. And so I developed my love for aviation right there and then, but of course really couldn't afford much until after got out of pharmacy school. And after, you know, John and I went to business, you know, back then when we first went to business, we couldn't even cash our own paychecks and we ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the first year. But once the business became successful where I could afford, you know, couple of friends and I decided we were going to go to Oshkosh. So we went to Oshkosh.
Which is the world's largest aviation event. I mean, there's nothing.
The largest aviation event in the world, right? And there were, I think, four of us went up there. And at that point, the hook was set. And there was nothing doing, but, you know, I couldn't throw that hook. We got back, this was early August, and I started looking around for a flight instructor. I found a flight instructor down at St. Mary's County Airport, John Chrisman, who was a helicopter pilot for the state of Maryland, Medivacs, and he was also a fixed-wing flight instructor. So talked to him and took my first lesson, first real lesson in a real airplane, you know, with a real flight instructor legally on the 23rd of September. And on the 24th of December, I took my check ride for private pilot, and I had bought a Cessna 182 and threw the family in the airplane the next day, and we flew to Florida for Christmas with the family. So
you got right into lesson. It. I'll say that much.
Well,
for you.
There wasn't no need to put it off.
That's right.
There wasn't no putting it off. The hook was set, and I had a hankering, as my mama would say. I had a hankering to get it done.
Well, I want to pivot here just a bit because this is important here. You got your license to learn, as they say, and worked your way up through your ratings all the way to a commercial pilot. And something happened there. You realized that there was sort of a mission in your life at some point during all of this to tell these stories.
Well, even, you know, by the time I got my private pilot, I was already hooked on, history. You know, sometimes I wonder if I wasn't, reborn from, another generation, a generation ago. You know, the house I live in was built 1860. I drive around town in a 1939 Cadillac, but I have always had, my father was a World War II veteran, and I saw what, I had learned very quickly what he had gone through. And my interest had always been in my library, about 3,000 books, and I read them all. They're all, World War II related histories, biographies, mission histories, et cetera. It's a fascinating period of time. It's the most significant time in the history of mankind. You know, it's basically 1935 to 1945. And I saw also how that history was so fast and so quickly being forgotten by a generation of people so fixated on themselves. And it became somewhat of a mission to me to tell that story. Early on in my flying career, I bought a UC-78, an old bamboo bomber, and restored it. Spent 3.5 years restoring it and began telling that story, not only locally, but, across the country as we travel around, doing air shows on the weekends. And expanded that, of course, bought the B-25 in 1997.
I want to talk about that a bit, because you bought this airplane, this B-25, the most recognizable B-25 in the world, Panjshido. And your buddy, yep, Tom Riley, our mutual friend, and you go down to pick it up. Tom had restored the airplane. It was on its way to France or something, if I recall.
Well, yeah, I had always, in 1992, I was at Oshkosh, with the bamboo bomber, and I was out there at the airplane, and it was, they were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Doolittle Raid. And there were 16 B-25s landing right over top of my head. And I'm looking at these airplanes, and that is the most magnificent warbird there is. What a unique airplane, and what a unique place in history. The airplane...
Sure.
Flown by 80 men, 16 airplanes, 80 men that changed the course of the war in the Pacific. There was a whole bunch of the Doolittle Raiders that were there in attendance, that year. And I thought, what a magnificent airplane. But, my life at that time was 7 days a week working. Only occasionally could I sneak away. And even then I had to make certain I was near a phone, because, running a business and 100 employees and nursing home clients, you don't tell somebody at 3 o'clock in the morning that they, if a doctor wants a dose of Kelpectate, they're going to get it at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning. That had been my life for 30 years. And then suddenly, 1997, we had this company that wanted to buy our company because of our history, our reputation, our client base. And so literally on a Monday morning, I literally sat up in bed, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I said, I can finally buy a B-25. I've always wanted a B-25. It is time for me to do something for myself. I've spent my entire life doing stuff for everybody else. I'm going to do this. I called Tom Riley, who I'd met at Oshkosh back in 1990. And when he showed up in a B-24, he had just restored and didn't even have a hotel reservation. But he showed up because he had just finished doing a restoration. And, of course, won, grand champion with the airplane. But I called Tom. I said, Tom, I want to buy a B-25. What's for sale? And he said, well, Panjshido is for sale. I said, wow, I know that airplane. That airplane's owned by Rick Korff. It's based up in Geneseo, National Warplane Museum. Well, he said, no, it's down here at Titusville. And Bayon Air Command's hangar. He said, Rick Korff has got it up for sale. So I said, okay, who's the broker? He told me. So I called the broker, asked him the price. Very reasonable. I said, that sounds good. And Denny Sherman. So I said, asked Denny the price. He said, but there is a couple of Frenchmen on their way here to buy the airplane. Well, I've been in business a long time. I know money talks, as they say, BS walks. So I said, Denny, is there any money on the table yet? He said, no. So, boy, this is something that could have backfired on me. I said, all right, call Rick. Tell him I'll give him a $10,000 cash deposit if he'll hold the airplane for me till Friday. This is Monday morning now, about 9 o'clock. If he'll hold the airplane to me for Friday. If I buy the airplane by Friday, it goes toward the purchase price. If I don't, he can keep the money. 5 minutes later, my phone rings. As Denny said, okay, Rick said he'll take you up on that. I said, what you going to tell the Frenchman? He said, I'll put him up in my hotel. They were literally in the air on an airliner on the way over. Wow. So I called Tom Riley. I said, Tom, how fast can you have $10,000 in Denny Sherman's hand? He said, about an hour and a half. I said, go to your bank, get 10 grand, cashier's check, take it to Denny. I mean, this is all being done on a handshake now. We didn't have any formal contracts. This is just all honest people. You know,
sure.
My daddy used to build houses on a handshake. Okay. So Tom borrowed a 172 from somebody there at the airport. He ran down to his bank, got a cashier's check, flew down to Dennis Sherman, gave him a deposit. And of course I went to my bank later that morning and had money transferred back to Tom Riley to cover the money he was taking out of his account. And so now I had a gentleman's agreement, didn't have a formal agreement, but I felt confident with it. Rick's an honest man. Denny Sherman certainly is. Tom Riley certainly is. And so we had an agreement. So, of course, this is before computers were quite so prevalent as they are today. Everybody didn't have personal PCs and stuff like we do today. Records weren't as computerized as they are today. So I had to start, you know, the record search and making certain there was no liens on the airplane, all that kind of stuff. I made arrangements to get down to Florida. I get down there on a Thursday. We start doing a pre-buy inspection. Tom finds a broken motor mount on the airplane. He repairs that, quote, warranty repair, even though he had finished the 15 years since his restoration.
Right.
He wanted me to own that airplane. It was always his favorite restoration. So it was a scramble for 2 days, Thursday and Friday, going through the pre-buy inspection, going through the parts inventory that was going along with it, all the paperwork, this and that. So on Friday afternoon, sun starting to set. We walk out in the hangar. I literally broke out in a cold sweat of anxiety. Holy, what have I done?
Yeah.
I'm standing there looking at an airplane. I didn't even know how to get in it.
Well, that was my point.
Up to Tom.
Yeah, how do I get
said,
in
Tom,
it?
He's hooking it up to a tug to tow it out. I said, how do I get in it? He lowered the hatch down and showed me how to get in. And I tell you, he started going through a start procedure. I thought, I will never learn this. He started flipping switches. You know, it takes three hands and a dozen fingers to start a B-25 between fuel boost pumps and igniters and energizer switches and stuff. You don't have to have a key to start this thing. You got to have a college degree just to figure out how to flip all the switches in the right sequence to get it started. Anyway, I'm thinking, ain't no way in the world I'm going to learn how to fly this, start this airplane. Now we teach it.
Yeah.
But
well,
you know,
and that's the point.
The airplane
is still, it's still in service to this great country of ours. You train a lot of folks how to fly it who are some of the best test pilots in the world these days.
Well, yeah, we do a class four times a year where we teach people how to fly the B-25. I've now accumulated about almost 2,400 hours in type in B-25. One of the highest time civilian pilots, you know, flying to be probably, I think I'm second or third highest time. You know, Paul Neuer and I are pretty close together right now, and Tom Riley's still number one, but we're both catching up with him pretty quickly. Tom's, you know, a little busy right now. We're restoring three or four B-17s, a P-51, and a couple of other airplanes. Even though he's 76 years old, he's still multiple restorations going on.
And the XP-82, of course, is for sale. At the time of broadcast, it'll be for sale.
Wow. What a magnificent airplane that thing is, too. What a unique airplane.
I want to bring this up, though,
too. A couple hundred parts to that airplane.
We just have a few minutes left, and I want to get to this. I don't want to miss it. Your rides program that is running right now, your Living History flights, they're up and running. So if someone who's hearing this would like to come up and take part in one of those at your museum in Georgetown, Delaware, I know there's a lot of folks that listen to this down south. Yes, it is north of the Mason-Dixon line, but Larry will take good care of you. Hill.
Well, we're only about 15 miles on the other side of Mason-Dixon line.
Just so over the border.
If you hold your breath, you're okay.
That's fine, though. So,
but we also take the airplane all over the country. You know, in October, we'll be down at the Lockheed Air and Space Show in Orlando. We'll be at Warriors and Warbirds, you know, in Monroe, North Carolina. You know, we travel with the plane. We'll be at Wings Over North Georgia, you know, in later this summer. So, but DelawareAviationMuseum.org is the website. And from there, you know, there's a link you can click on, takes you to a phone number, shows you our schedule, where we're going to be, and we'll work out things. But one thing, Matt, we want to make certain, you know, that I have spent the 23 years that I've owned this airplane and a number of years before that, making, I guess you could say, life's work out of trying to help the world remember the veterans that fought in World War II, you know, and what this whole country went through during that time. You know, so few people today have an understanding of what a maximum effort World War II was. Yes, it wasn't fought on United States soil except for the Aleutian Islands, but it was a total commitment. People, young men standing in line to volunteer, knowing that they had less than a 50% chance of surviving, you know, their missions to come home, but they still stand in line and volunteer. Losses were extremely heavy in the early months of the war. The first couple of years of the war, 1943, there was still first daylight bombing mission over in Berlin, for instance. One commander launched his entire command that morning, and that afternoon, his entire command was nothing but the ground crew personnel. He lost all of his airplanes. All 16 B-17s were shot down. He lost his entire command on one mission. People today, you know, they don't understand what a commitment that was. And other men just stepped right into that position, stepped right up, put me in, coach, and went in. Today you see what's going on in our cities, and I write, these people have no concept. They have no concept, you know, of what America is really about. And till I draw my last breath, I'm going to keep trying to tell that story.
Well, Larry Kelly, you're a man on a mission, and I appreciate you coming on this show and sharing a little bit about it. Again, you're going to be around the country if folks want to come see you in Panchito. Don't get out west a whole lot. But if they want to come out here and see you, you'd love to see them. Of course, it's Delaware, the Delaware Aviation Museum Foundation, and you can find out more about them by visiting their website, which we'll quick link into this show. Larry, thanks for coming on. I look forward to seeing you down the road somewhere.
Matt, it's always good to see you. It's always good to talk to you and to share that whole passion for that generation and that era.
Well, next time you come on, we'll tell the story about a little town in Missouri.
And that's we'll tell a half-hour story in itself.
We'll tell the story about
Kennett, Missouri is
we'll tell
that it. Is a story worth telling.
It is. Yeah. And we'll tell it next time. It's history worth saving, and so are you. Larry Kelly, thanks for being here. Folks, you can find out more about Larry by just visiting the website quick linked into the show story. Remember to sign up for the newsletter for History Worth Saving. And I am so serious when I say this. When you sign up, it helps us out more than you can ever imagine. When you share this show and other people listen to it, it helps build this community. Remember, this country, so deeply divided right now, cannot heal itself if we don't get to know our neighbor. You can't relate to somebody if you don't know them. You can't like them. You certainly can't love them if you just don't know them. So what we're trying to do and what we've been trying to do from day one, tell great American stories, regardless of the side of the fence that it's on, and just let you get to know people. So I hope you'll be a part of this great experiment as we continue at historyworthsaving.com. Again, historyworthsaving.com. If you're just listening to us, please go there, sign up today, and subscribe to the show and the newsletter. Thanks again, folks. Get out and know your neighbors. Until next time, I'm Matt Jolly, and this is History Worth Saving.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.